Okay, well let's go ahead and come on in and get started with our class this morning. Looks like this is about us. Let's just for a little review. Yesterday we talked about this affinity that we have here in the 18th chapter of 2 Chronicles. So be sure and have your Bibles open there. That's what we're reading out of today. How Jehoshaphat had riches and honor and abundance and a joint affinity with Ahab. And so this is kind of where we left off. We had an idea yesterday. We were talking about the harmony, the melody of a sweet song, and how we raise our prayers, our psalms, our hymns, our spiritual songs in unity with one voice, praising and giving glory to God. And we should have no association with the evil works of darkness. And we see that this was the theme of our chapter 18, is Jehoshaphat goes down. And that's what's taking place here now. And so yesterday we had a quote with some interesting and very pertinent statements. And the quote spoke of sound principles in contrast to a policy of emotion. To faithfully implement the terms of fellowship, knowing the standards of our Master, and to strengthen those things of doctrine that bind us together in the one hope of His calling. Knowing that the time is drawing nigh, the writer says we cannot compromise and then wait in regret of our fateful decision. So we must do what is right and be valiant for the truth and teach it without compromise, and all lovers of the truth will then approve. And of course, we're familiar with the words of Brother Thomas. And so we truly get the lesson here to be careful of the company that we keep. So where was Jehoshaphat in all this? We saw in the 17th chapter how he had strengthened himself, how he had risen above the things of Israel. But we came to the conclusion yesterday that the riches and honor that he had in abundance, as well as the strength of blessing and peace that God had given him, he possibly felt that it was his opportunity now to reach out to Ahab and Jezebel in the north. He possibly thought that he now possessed the strength to try to bring them back in, to try to make them understand, possibly, to begin with a friendship, to begin with a relationship that maybe seemed harmless at the first, but we see in the end of this chapter how it led to death. Well, of course, the death of Ahab, which was prophesied before, but definitely the reprimand of Jehoshaphat and all of his people. So that's where we start this morning, thinking of this, considering this chapter. We see how Ahab had slaughtered the sheep and oxen himself for Jehoshaphat. And so from this, in the record, we see that he may have considered himself a sort of high priest of his new system. And keep in mind then that it says that he persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. Now we talked yesterday about how he was old hat at this persuasion stuff because he was living with Jezebel. He knew all about being goaded and prodded and poked as a thorn. And so he knew how to manipulate Jehoshaphat into thinking that this was something that he should do. Ahab would not have recognized, possibly, that this specific city is Ramoth-Gilead, and under the old provision of the land and the law, this was a city of refuge. A city of refuge. Now, this was a city that was set up in case of an accidental killing, where the person could flee to this city in order to flee the retribution or the vengeance of a family member who may have possibly been killed accidentally. So here we have an interesting thought. Here we have in 1 Kings the account of Ahab's murdering Naboth, the way this was set up with Jezebel. We have him here as this pseudo high priest of his own system, who is a murderer himself, and then going to this city of refuge. So let's keep all this in mind now as we flow through this portion of our study here in this chapter. And the third verse we have Ahab saying, "Wilt thou go with me to Ramoth-Gilead?" And so to make sure that Jehoshaphat would agree, he asks him plainly, "Will you do this?" And Jehoshaphat then replies, And it's hard for us to even believe that he would reply in such a way. He says there that I am as thou art, and my people as thy people. So, brethren, we see from this that he completely identifies himself. He completely identifies himself and his people with Ahab and all of the atrocities that were taking place in the northern kingdom. He, in effect, says, you represent me and my people as thy people. Again, how do we understand how Jehoshaphat must have had this in his mind? Did he think that he must completely relate, completely give over to Ahab in order to try to influence him in the right way? Was that his thinking? Well, we know more often than not, when we go into a relationship or some sort of a discussion with this in mind, that this isn't the way it usually turns out. And this is exactly what takes place here with Ahab. Don't we also, in this particular place, consider the verse or the words of Amos when he says, can two walk together except they be agreed? Well, now these two were in agreement. They were in fellowship, if you will, by him stating, I am as thou art, and my people as thy people. So this wasn't just a casual, haphazard agreement between this. This was a full giving over or coercion by these two together in unity. And so look at the words again. I am as thou art, and my people as thy people. He says, we will be with thee. And where else do we remember a phrase with this sort of connotation? Well, we might remember the words of Ruth. And I thought this was interesting how it fits so closely to what Ruth had said in our studies of Ruth, chapter 1, verse 16. Now, a little background, we remember that Elimelech had taken his wife and his sons, Mahlon and Chilion, down into the land of Moab. And we see as a result of all of this, all of them died. That is, three out of four of them had died. They had left the boundaries of the promised land due to doubt and faithlessness and had entered into Moab. Look at the type that's left there for us. Leaving the promised land, the boundaries, the sanctity of an ecclesia possibly, due to doubt and entering into Moab, entering into the world. But it was all for a purpose, we see. And then Ruth comes up with Naomi and she dedicates herself to the God of Israel. And this is what Ruth says to Naomi as she goes through her own spiritual baptism, in effect, and committed her life to Yahweh. And this was all for this particular purpose of gaining Ruth. And we know where Ruth fits in the lineage of Christ. And so Jehoshaphat takes Ruth's pledge, however, and instead he turns it around and pledges his allegiance now to Ahab. Ruth said, whither thou goest, I will go to Naomi. Whither thou lodgest, I will lodge, she said. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Think of the tenderness that's involved with Ruth and Naomi in this very special interaction here. And we see that it's such a shame that Jehoshaphat would apply Ruth's beautiful oath to a very wicked individual in King Ahab. And as we continue, we see Jehoshaphat asks a very telling question of Ahab in verse 4, where he says, and Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today. Now think about that. He goes to him and he says, let's inquire of the word of the Lord today. Now, as we go through this account, let's see some of the little details, the blurb that sticks out to us. First of all, he says, the word of the Lord. And of course, we know this would be translated Yahweh. Is there anyone, I pray thee, at the word of Yahweh today? So again, we see this inquiring mind of Jehoshaphat, seeking. This is used 15 times in this account of Ahab, 15 times in this particular chapter. And seek the word of Yahweh today seems to be the theme. And so it's obvious here to us that Jehoshaphat has gotten things out of order, though, hasn't he? Where is he at in this account? He's already made his affinity. He's already initiated of his own accord an alliance with Ahab. And then he agrees to go to war with him. Our people as your people. We'll go to war. And then he says here, well, we should seek the word of Yahweh. We should hear his instruction. Is there anything out of sync here for us, brethren? Of course. Of course. The problem here is that he had already done all of his committing, hadn't he? And this is definitely not the order that we want to go about in our service. And we see that we always must first seek the Lord for help and wisdom in whatever we are doing. First, seek first the Lord. If we think that it's a small and insignificant decision that we can take upon ourselves, we may be wrong. We may be out of line. We always have to seek first. And of course, Proverbs 3, 5-7 says, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him," or as we saw in our first class, "know him, and he shall direct thy paths. Be not wise in thine own eyes, but fear the Lord, and depart from evil." Be not wise in thine own eyes. Did Jehoshaphat think he was wise enough now, strong enough now, and of course wealthy enough, and he had plenty of soldiers? Was this his own wisdom that he was applying in this application without first seeking the Lord? But now he has things out of whack. After this affinity has already begun, he's already given his son to Athaliah, he's already begun this, he says, oh, by the way, maybe we should seek the Lord. Well, let's continue in verse 5. He says, "Therefore the king of Israel gathered together of the prophets 400 men, and said unto them, Shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And they said, Go up, for God will deliver it into the king's hand." Well, there you go. There you go. There's his assurance, isn't it? That's all he needed. After Jehoshaphat says, let's ask Yahweh, "Therefore the king of Israel gathered together the prophets 400 men." Now, let's stop for a second and ask ourselves, who are these 400 men? Well, in our studies of Elijah and Elisha, we may have a good inclination of who these 400 are, right? Think back to Elijah's victory on Mount Carmel. There were 450 prophets of Baal, and there were 400 prophets of the grove in that account that were left beside. 400 prophets of the grove. This is in 1 Kings 18. So Jehoshaphat says, let's inquire of Yahweh. And Ahab says, okay, let me call in 400 of my prophets of the grove. Completely out of line. Completely. No association to the God of heaven. Ahab proceeds to ask these prophets, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And then these prophets tell him exactly what he wants to hear, doesn't he? Go up, for God will deliver it into the king's hand. And notice the response. Go up, for God will deliver it into thine hand. It doesn't say Yahweh. It speaks of Elohim. And this could be used in a general sense of one who is to be worshipped. So did they still put their hope and their guidance in the prophets of Baal? And the prophets of Baal, of course, worshipping him, worshipping this false god. It seems to be implied here, for go up, God will deliver him. Because we know the God of heaven, the real God, Yahweh, God of Israel, had nothing to do with delivering Ahab. He had already prophesied in chapters before how Ahab would be killed. So Jehoshaphat replies by asking, yes, but is there not a prophet of Yahweh besides that we might inquire? Seek him. Let's seek him. Is there not a single prophet? How bad have things really gotten in Israel? Well, they were pretty bad, but it seems as though he was blind to maybe some of the things that were taking place. And now doesn't this seem like the most opportune time, brothers and sisters, for Jehoshaphat to back out of this situation when they can't even find a true prophet of Yahweh? When he brings these prophets of Baal in, wouldn't this have been the time for him to say, you know what, I don't really think we're seeing eye to eye on this particular thing. It's time for me to back out. But Jehoshaphat still must have felt he could reach out, he could reach into this fiery situation and deliver maybe his brethren in Israel. Shouldn't he realize now that they really weren't compatible, that they obviously had different gods that they were serving, even by the terms, the structure of the record that we have here before us? Jehoshaphat doesn't seem to see what is obvious to us. Ahab replies by mentioning someone that he really doesn't like now. It's almost comical in a way because he says there that, well, yes, there is one man that I can inquire of Yahweh. And notice here he does say Yahweh, the Lord. He acknowledges the difference in this man and who he abides with, but he's definitely not happy with him. But we see how he mentions him. He says he hates him. He flat out comes out and says, I hate him. I lost my track here in the scripture, but we're in verse 6. Jehoshaphat said, is there not a prophet? Verse 7, the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, there's this man, Micaiah. And so they bring him in. Micaiah, his name means, who is like Yah? I thought this was interesting because he is definitely implementing the will and the purpose of Yahweh and showing these men what he wants. They don't seem to be listening, though. So Micaiah, who is like Yah? And this is why he is opposed to Ahab continually, because he comes out now as one of the stars in this account against Ahab. But look at Jehoshaphat's response. Does this give us a clue as to how he was truly gone? He had truly gone down to Ahab. He was now on the same level as Ahab. Can we imagine how he would have replied a few years earlier as he sat upon the throne of David in Jerusalem and educated his people with judgment and justice to encourage them? How would he have responded then? This was 10 years later. He might have said something like, you hate this man because he doesn't condone your wicked behavior, Ahab. He would have given him all that he had. He probably would have stood up and left the room abruptly. However, instead, we see Jehoshaphat's reply, which seems to be somewhat weak. He says instead, oh, let not the king say so. Or in other words, come on, don't be that way. He's really not that bad. Jehoshaphat may be shocked in a way, but he says nothing. He does nothing, and he takes no action as he tolerates Ahab's inappropriate words against a man of God. And so they go to fetch Micaiah, and we see the two kings sitting here described in verse 9. The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, sat either one of them on his throne, clothed in their robes, and they sat in a void place at their entering in of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. Who are the prophets again? Think of all of these prophets of Baal. Think of the description that took place on Mount Carmel as they jumped around, cutting themselves with knives, and yelling and shouting and chanting. Is this what was taking place here as Jehoshaphat sat quietly, complacently, and watched? These two kings were sitting together, as we see in the record, and sitting together here denotes or represents fellowship, doesn't it? They were sitting in an empty or void place. Doesn't that shout at us exactly what was taking place? They were void here, void of the truth and the true worship of Yahweh. And so consequently, it's a void. They were void of his help and void of his compassion. And they were clothed in these robes. Clothed in their robes. This was their outward expression of their authority and rulership. Right. This was given to them by Yahweh. Right. And yet now they abused this authority by first forsaking the Lord God for his help. And as for Jehoshaphat, he was now in fellowship with a worker of iniquity, and these robes were unfitting for what Yahweh had intended for the king, for the leader of his people. And so looking at the word robes, we see it's interesting that it means a covering, naturally, but also it means treachery, or figuratively to act covertly, to deal deceitfully. And this seems to be the way it was happening with Jehoshaphat and his people. He had encouraged them so much. He had built them up and given them the strength and the tools to work with to combat iniquity and false worship. And yet now he was working behind the scenes and allying himself and his people with idol worshipers. Covertly, dealing deceitfully, working undercover and treacherously. Let's look at Psalm 1 for a minute. You know, Psalm 1 says, "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly," as Brother Robert brought to us this morning, "nor standing in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful." All of this, excellent words for one who is trying to walk justly. But we see the description here of these, the ungodly, the sinner, the scornful, walking, standing, sitting. All of these are actions showing us to not take action and sit and ally ourselves with the ungodly, with the sinner, with the scornful. Let's don't come alongside by walking, sitting as these two were, or standing, taking action. By seeking Yahweh after the fact, they were in effect dealing deceitfully, and they had left, Jehoshaphat had left all of his principles behind. Verse 10 and 11 we see in the record, "And Zedekiah the son of Shechaniah had made him horns of iron and said, Thus saith the Lord, with these shalt thou push Syria until they be consumed. And all the prophets prophesied, saying, Go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king." So again, think of the environment that was taking place here. Think of Elijah, Mount Carmel, these prophets of Baal, and how they would have behaved. 400 men here were possibly doing the same thing, chanting and acting out, trying to give Ahab confidence in what they were wanting to say, speaking this lie. Just like a pagan ritual unfolding before Jehoshaphat. And so then we see that the messenger goes to fetch Micaiah. In verse 12, he goes and gets him. But he gives him some specific instructions, doesn't he, as he's coming back. He says, "And the messenger that went to call Micaiah spake to him, saying, Behold, the words of the prophets declare good to the king with one assent. Let thy words, therefore, I pray thee, be like one of theirs, and speak thou good." Tell him something that he wants to hear. Tell him something that it's easy to pick up on. Let thy words be like theirs. But this didn't bother Micaiah, as we see. He responds boldly by saying, "As Yahweh liveth, even what my God saith, that will I speak." What a confident and impressive thing to say in front of Ahab and Jehoshaphat. We know that it's always hard to take a stand like Micaiah did. Maybe it's hard at school or at work. Maybe it's even times at gatherings or things that we need to really make sure of where we're at. When a discussion or a conversation starts to drift where you know it shouldn't, it's the time to speak up. But sometimes it's very hard. Who are we going to be like? Jehoshaphat sitting there complacently? Or Micaiah, who stood up and proclaimed the words of Yahweh? It was times like this, times like we see here, we need to be like Micaiah. One man, one, standing before these two kings and before these 400 ranting and raving false prophets, opponents of Yahweh. And though it would be very tempting to change his message or to soften it in some way, Micaiah stands up for God and he does what is right, no matter the consequences. And the consequences we see are often very severe. And this is truly the example that Jehoshaphat needs right now. He needs to see this man willing to make a stand and say and do what is right. And look at the short phrase that Micaiah says here and think how Jehoshaphat must have felt when he heard these words, when he said, "Even what my God saith, that will I speak." He doesn't look at Jehoshaphat and say, "What our God says." Because frankly, Jehoshaphat was not acting like he was a servant of Yahweh at this point. Jehoshaphat probably knew that Micaiah was the better man. And he should have been there standing beside him instead of sitting next to Ahab. So we see, "And when he was come to the king," verse 14, "that the king said unto him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And he says, Go up and prosper, and they shall be delivered into your hand." And the king, Ahab, knew. He could read between the lines, we might say. He said, "How many times shall I adjure thee that thou say nothing but the truth to me in the name of the Lord?" And then he said, "I did see all Israel scattered upon the mountains, as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, These have no master. Let them return, therefore, every man to his house in peace." And here we go with Ahab again. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Didn't I tell you that he was going to do this to me? Didn't I say that he would not prophesy good unto me, but evil? Why are we even going with this guy? He always says things against me." And so we have this laid out here. Ahab wasn't determined. If he wasn't so determined to do evil, then why Micaiah may not have been saying these. But we see that he was truly determined to follow through with what he thought was the best interest. But this wasn't in God's plan. And so Micaiah was telling him exactly what would be the result of this battle. Israel scattered upon the mountains, sheep with no shepherd. No deliverance for Ahab, but of course his life being taken. So the next portion of this, in verses 18 on, it's really interesting to see how it gives us insight into how the angels, how the court of heaven may work. And we see that he says, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord." This is Micaiah again speaking. He says, "I saw the Lord sitting upon his throne, and all the host of heaven standing on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, Who shall entice Ahab, king of Israel, that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one spake, saying after this manner, and another spake after that manner. Then there came out a spirit, and he stood before the Lord, and he said, I will entice him. And the Lord said unto him, Wherewith? And he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And the Lord said, Thou shalt entice him, and thou shalt also prevail. Go out and do even so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of these thy prophets, and the Lord hath spoken evil against thee." So we kind of see how this is working, aren't we? We have Yahweh, we have the angels, these spirits. He stood, standing. And by this depiction, it tells us that this is the angels of the Lord that are there. Sometimes we think of angels as God's robots, just randomly, or not randomly, but specifically, methodically, acting out on his will. But passages like this kind of suggest to us that this isn't the case. We see that although Yahweh works through his angels, the Elohim, his purpose cannot and will not fail. We see in the record there, how are we going to have Ahab go up and be killed at Ramoth-Gilead? How is this going to happen? We see the end purpose, the end result was there. But the question was, how are we going to bring this about? And so in this particular case, God has already said that he will die at Ramoth-Gilead. It's going to happen. It has to happen, and it cannot fail. God has commissioned certain angels here to bring this to pass because this is what angels do. They work on God's behalf to fulfill his purpose. But how exactly was this going to happen? And so we see in verses 20 and 21, it depicts the scene of this discussion between them and how it would take place. "I," says one, "will be this lying spirit." He presents his suggestion about this lying spirit, and then God gives his approval, and the angel is sent out to perform this work. God's will is to be fulfilled no matter what. And it seems, though, that this angel used his own initiative in bringing this about. And so what was this lying spirit about? Well, do angels lie? Can angels sin? Well, of course not. This wasn't the purpose here. God can and will use the particular character of individuals and persons, whether positive or negative, to achieve his goal, right? And so the angel says, "I will make sure that the prophets of Baal tell the lies that are necessary so that the whole plan goes forward and Ahab dies in Ramoth-Gilead." And isn't this a perfect way for Ahab to meet his demise? Ahab was a man who lived by a lying spirit, by lying. He lived on lies, and his wife ensured that. And so the prophets were employed by him to tell these lies. They didn't prophesy truth. They merely spoke what Ahab and Jezebel wanted them to speak. They told them that they needed to hear what they needed to hear, and this was what was happening here for them to continue to fulfill God's plan. And yet through it all, we see Yahweh is truly in control every situation, just as he always is. And so the angels knew that Ahab had surrounded himself with people whose sole purpose was to deceive and lie, and so it was perfect to use this lying spirit to bring about his destruction, because Ahab was choosing this for himself already. And so what we can gather from this lesson is that God won't always stop us. He will not always stop us when we are intent on following our own path, or when we are intent on following or serving sin. In fact, God may let those very sins swallow us up. God let Ahab's spirit of lying swallow him up. But in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9 and 10, Paul is warning the Thessalonian ecclesia of false religious system, which would work its way among them, which would begin from among them. And it was going to thrive on lying and deceiving people. And Paul says that because this system is not interested in believing or supporting truth, God will allow that lying system to deceive nations of the world, much like Ahab and Jezebel. And what we're being told here is that we can choose the path of our own destruction if we aren't careful and seek the Lord, to seek Yahweh always. And so we see as it spread out there, apostasy began, and it slowly crept into the crevices of every nation and every church. And we see it rampant in the world that we live in today. And it began in those early first century ecclesias. So, to finish this section, we understand that the vision of Micaiah shows a stark contrast between Ahab's judgment hall and where they were sitting here in this void place, and the heavenly court that Micaiah was describing to them, where Yahweh and the angels were working out to direct their lives. They had their own leader, they both had their own messengers, and they both had their own spirit about them. And Micaiah is drawing everyone's attention now to the enormous difference between God's ways and Ahab's ways. Imagine now, this was in an open void place, so there was probably plenty of spectators, not to mention the 400 prophets of Baal. And here is where Jehoshaphat and Ahab sat, either one of them on his throne. But Micaiah says, "I saw Yahweh sitting upon his throne." The court of Ahab, with all the 400 prophets prophesying before him, we saw in verse 18, all the host of heaven is on God's right hand and on his left. So we have the contrast there between the two. In the court of Ahab, we had the messenger, which is the word Malak, meaning angel. And he was sent to call Micaiah. And in the court of heaven, there came out a spirit or an angel, didn't he, to go forward with the purpose of Yahweh. Again, the similarity that fits here. And so we see Micaiah was smitten and thrown into prison in the end, in verse 26, and fed with the bread of affliction, because of how upset and distraught that Ahab became. Ahab says, "Until I return in peace." Now, this is on down to verse 26. "Thus saith the king, put this fellow in the prison and feed him with the bread of affliction and with the water of affliction until I return in peace." Look at the confidence in the words of Ahab. He was confident in the words of his prophets. But he ignored all of what Micaiah had just said. He ignored the words of the prophet who told him in 1 Kings 20, "Thy life for his life, and thy people for his people." Speaking of Ben-Hadad, see, Ahab was supposed to kill Ben-Hadad early on as he battled against the Syrians. But Ahab preserved him. Doesn't this kind of sound like Saul, as he preserved the king? He tried to preserve all that was good. Maybe Ahab felt that if he preserved the king's life, he would somehow be able to form an alliance with him somehow. Well, this was his downfall because God said, "For thy life, for his life, and thy people, for his people." So instead of entering into a covenant with Ben-Hadad, he began immediately to scheme, Ben-Hadad did, began immediately to scheme how he was going to kill Ahab. And so we see that fulfilled here in this chapter. Ahab wasn't going to go and return in peace. We know that. Verse 27, "And Micaiah said, If thou wilt certainly return in peace, then hath not the Lord spoken by me. And he said, Hearken, all ye people." In other words, you will not return in peace, because this truly is the word of Yahweh. We really never hear much about Micaiah again after this. He's hauled out. And as he's hauled out, he says, "Hearken, all ye people." Or as the record in 1 Kings 22 says, "Hearken, O people, every one of you." You can imagine Micaiah being hauled out in chains, speaking these words directly to the faces of these false prophets. And who was sitting right there listening? Who was posed there with his robe on right next to Ahab? It was King Jehoshaphat, watching as Micaiah was hauled out. And it's ironic, brethren, because think about this. It already happened once in his life, right? He had already seen how his father Asa had been reproved by the prophet when he was a young man. I wonder if his conscience bothered him at all as he thought about this. And remember, Jehoshaphat's father, at the end of his life, as he heard these words, he had the prophet thrown into prison as well for speaking truth. His father got diseased in his feet and died. And so Jehoshaphat is sitting here in his splendor, and Micaiah takes the hard road while Jehoshaphat sits in the cushioned throne next to Ahab. And just like Hananiah the seer in 2 Chronicles 16, he was thrown into prison. These men took the just way. They took the highway, even though it resulted in dire consequences. Asa was very angry with him, and he put him into the prison house, as we said. Does Jehoshaphat feel compelled to stop this at all? Does he reflect on what took place with his father? All it would take is for him to stand up in a moment, to stand up on behalf of the prophet, to stand on the side of the truth. But instead, he does nothing. He does nothing. He sits there. And so to finish this section of the account in our lesson, we see that the battle turns out exactly as Micaiah had prophesied. The Syrians were victorious, Ahab is dead, and Jehoshaphat barely makes it back alive, and the people are scattered like sheep without a shepherd. And we see here that Yahweh is very merciful to Jehoshaphat, which goes back to our note on the city of refuge, right? The city of refuge. Jehoshaphat truly found refuge as Yahweh had provided and saved him from certain death. We don't have time to go through the account, but we see how these men of the Syrian army were about to kill him. But he shouted out and said, "There's Ahab, go get him, he's over there." And that's what they did. They went after Ahab. And we see that it's interesting because in verse 33, a certain man drew a bow at a venture. In other words, randomly, this man just draws a bow. He shoots the arrow into the air, and lo and behold, it just happens to smote Ahab between the breastplate, and he dies. Was that random? I don't think so. So this is what happens at the end of the chapter. Jehoshaphat, though, our lesson in this, as he found refuge, even though he had made such a terrible decision, even though he had aligned himself and his people with Ahab, God felt pity for him and mercy, and he gave him refuge. So, let's ask ourselves, brothers and sisters, does this sound like us sometimes? I know it sounds like me. We set ourselves on a road, and we decide which path that we're going to take before we even consult our Father. We don't engage in prayer. We don't discuss this with our loved ones, our parents, or those in our ecclesia sometimes, we just do it because we think it's right and it's fitting in our life, don't we? Often there are signposts all along the way discouraging us, just as there were signposts in Jehoshaphat's life, showing him and telling him what he should do. More often than not, we remain silent as well. If we were bothered to read these signposts and react to them, often we wouldn't go down that path. We do our best sometimes to ignore these posts and these signs the whole way, all because more often than not, we feel we are strong enough and capable enough to handle these things on our own. Doesn't this describe Jehoshaphat? Didn't he feel like he was strong enough to handle this on his own? To possibly convince his erring brethren? And yet he was nearly killed by doing this. Sometimes we even start relationships like Jehoram, like he did, with those who are really spiritually incompatible with us. Sometimes, brethren, we get into very sticky situations, but it's only by God's grace. Only by God's grace. Only by God's grace that He rescues us at the last minute. So we have to be very thankful. We have to be very, very thankful that God is able to pluck us out of the fire. God can certainly rescue us from the lowest points in our life, but we have to learn from our mistakes, don't we? We have to learn. We have to learn from our mistakes. Does Jehoshaphat then live to see another day and to learn from his mistakes? Well, we find out in the next chapter. Thankfully, he does. And it's here we see that he breaks his ties, his alliance with Israel in the north. Of course, Ahab is gone now. And the northern kingdom of Israel, of course, is dispersed. The armies, that is, they're all dispersed, and they go back where they were. So we might see a summary of the principles that we see here that we began with yesterday. We see that relationships and marriage are to be built on the unity of mind and must be within God's perimeter. They must be built within God's perimeters. We need to create harmony and not dissension. The sweet songs of being in tune, the same notes, the same melodies, to even be on the same page of music. Prayer must come before the decisions of any kind and not afterwards. God won't force us to change the direction of our life if we don't want to. We must answer for the deeds that we do, the decisions, and the consequences that follow. From Micaiah, we learned that we must confidently speak the truth in whatever circumstances, and regardless of any and all consequences. It may mean the bread and water of affliction, as we see was described for him. But if it's right, it's the right thing to do, then we must remain firm and confident and do it. Our Heavenly Father can rescue us, and don't we gain strength and comfort in knowing that our Father can rescue us, as he did Jehoshaphat, from all of our blunders, of our ill decisions, the things that we make, if we can cry out with true and sincere prayer, relying on our Father, just as Jehoshaphat did. And so, the words of Micaiah, we see, come back. In the next chapter, we see Jehoshaphat learns his lesson, and he tells the people to deal courageously, and Yahweh will be with the good. Our character study in the life and times, the character and experiences of Jehoshaphat, the lofty heights that he reached, and the devastating low that he came to as well, we saw Jehoshaphat was a man with really good intentions, didn't he? He had great motives, but at times he lacked the ability to put his foot down and to take a stand, to realize he had made an improper decision and take a new course of action. We see that he soared to great spiritual heights in chapter 17 and at the beginning of his reign. But then 10 years later, he made this ill choice and formed this alliance with Ahab. Now in chapter 19 here, we say that we might see Jehoshaphat is limping back to Jerusalem after this disaster that takes place in chapter 18. He has the words of Micaiah ringing in his ears, as he probably should, as he came back, trembling in fear from his close encounter with death. And as we mentioned here earlier, what were the prophetic words of 2 Chronicles 18:16 that Micaiah spoke? Well, we see here that he says, all the people were scattered. And this fits because we see that all Judah had come together with Israel to battle against the Syrian army. They had sheep. They were as sheep that have no shepherd. And Ahab was now dead. And at this time, Jehoshaphat had become spiritually dead. He was certainly in no position to act as a shepherd, especially in the capacity that he had done in the years before. There was now no master to lead them, and it was every man, or every soldier, we might say, for himself. And they were to let them return every man, said Micaiah. And so both Judah and Israel returned to their respective places, to their cities, no longer in alliance together, but assessing the damage that was done and going back to what they know, king or no king. And as he said, return every man to his house in peace. The Syrians, especially their king Ben-Hadad, were only after one thing, and that was Ahab's head. They didn't pursue any of Judah or Israel after this point, and so they both were able to return in peace. Chapter 19:1, we see Jehoshaphat is doing the same thing, not as a defeated shepherd or as a king, but just as any average man, as Micaiah said, every man returning to his house. And Jehoshaphat had shirked his responsibility as the leader of God's people and had narrowly escaped with his own skin, just as any other man. And so it was time for him to do some self-examination, some soul-searching, and find out what was his next course of action. He had seen so much of this before with his father Asa. Was he going to follow that path? What was he going to fall back on? What was his foundation? What now would become the pillars for him to stand on and to proceed forward? Jehoshaphat had failed to see some of these things before him, and he chose to act outside his normal character. And now he was left reeling from this terrible decision. But we see that he came back to his house, and here we see the word house is derived from the root word bana, to build or to repair or to set up or to make sure. So Jehoshaphat now seems to be willing to pull himself back up, to go back to what he knew was truth. He seems to be willing to build, to repair, to set up and make sure of what he knew his confidence should be placed in. And in this chapter, we see this is exactly what he does. He returns to what he knows is right in the eyes of Yahweh. He acts now like the man Yahweh knew he could be as leader of his people. And he now comes back within his normal characteristics of a true spiritual leader, to lead the people, to build up and repair not only his house, but the house of Yahweh, and to set it back up and to see again the one true God who was leading these people. But this took an intervention, again, to make him come to this conclusion. He wasn't left all on his own. And as he returns to Jerusalem, we see in verse 2 that he's met by a certain man, chapter 19 of 2 Chronicles, verse 2, and Jehu, the son of Hanani on the scene again here, Hanani the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, shouldest thou love the ungodly? Shouldest thou help the ungodly, and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord. Shouldest thou help the ungodly? Were you thinking you could really make a difference with Jezebel? Did you really think you could reach out and bring her back into the ecclesia of God? Did you really feel like you loved those who hate the Lord? Why were you in that position to begin with? But this intervention took place, and again it came to this conclusion that we see. We see that we last found that Jehu, or his father Hanani, back in 2 Chronicles 16, verse 7, was the one speaking to Asa. And now we look at Asa's reaction, where he had him thrown into jail. Asa couldn't accept the rebuke, and we see here the similarity with Asa's response and Ahab's response in the previous chapter. They were both put into prison. The question now is, how does Jehoshaphat react to the words? It's sort of a deja vu all over again, isn't it? We had Asa and Hanani, and now Jehoshaphat and Jehu, and both were the sons of the previous. And it's now the next generation with the same action and the same rebuke. But how would this generation take this? How would they proceed forward? And we look and see how he does in the next portion of this study. So we'll probably stop there. We're out of time, and we'll pick up with his reaction tomorrow.